plan.
Here, do your thing.
What thing?
It's your lightsaber, take it.
You keep it.
What?
I don't need it. Besides, you've been training.
Very funny.
No, I'm serious.
Take it.
I gave it to you, it's yours now.
At least take a blaster.
No, the Force is my ally. That's all I need.
Well, I'm gonna need more than that.
Welcome, everyone, from across the universe to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Star Wars is for everyone, so pull up a chair, get comfortable, and join the conversation with your hosts, Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt, here in the Wampa's Lair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast, part of the Thunderquack Podcast Network. This is episode number 551, Top 5 Ahsoka Moments. I'm, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me, the Ezra and Sabine, to my Huyang, we've got Carl LeClaire and Jen Sobchak Joy Bankard.
Hey, Jen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Hopefully we're following standard Jedi protocol.
The Jedi are gone, Jen. Let it go.
You mentioned doing things. I was...
Right. But was there ever any standard Jedi protocol when it came to Ezra and Sabine?
Good point.
I don't think so.
Ezra for sure was a Boken Jedi, so Sabine came out of nowhere. So I think we're all set with ignoring protocol.
Great. That's just
well,
what
thank
wanted.
You. Thank you so much for having me. just going to say thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be back and amazing to have an excuse to revisit this amazing series.
Yeah, I've been talking about it a lot lately, mainly through social media, but the Ahsoka show has definitely become my favorite Star Wars story in the Disney era, except for maybe Solo. Solo still probably edges it out. But I love this show, and we love Top 5 here in the Wampa's Lair. And Jason and I were talking about how excited we'd be to do a Top 5 about the Ahsoka show. And when we were thinking about that, I was like, well, I know the perfect guest, because Jen loves Ahsoka and is brilliant, so let's get her.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jen, it's crazy to think that it was already almost 2 months ago that we got to meet up at the USC campus. And I still really appreciate you showing me the George Lucas and John Williams buildings and then going to Scum and Villainy with me. And oh, that was so much fun, even though it rained the entire time.
I know. I feel bad that we didn't have more California weather for you. But yeah, it was a really great time. I don't know how long it would have taken me to make it out to Scum and Villainy without you providing the invitation, so I really appreciate that.
Oh yeah, I and while the rain was annoying, I mean, I just tried to pretend I was on Kamino. So I just kept looking for somebody to clone me. You know, who wouldn't want two Carls in the world? So
I think I can safely say everyone. One is enough.
So. Oh my goodness. But yeah, folks, we are here to discuss our current top five moments from the Ahsoka show, because I think and this is what I kind of wanted to just before we even get into our moments, y'all, I was really curious. I was saying this to Jason a few minutes before you hopped on, Jen, but I really struggled with this top five. I've never had such a hard time compiling my list of top five, and I'm not sure exactly why it was. It's because there's so many moments in the show that I love that it was really hard for me to siphon it down to five. And I'm not sure if maybe that's just it. We're still so close to it. And, you know, I mean, Jason, we've done top fives for the new movies, usually like a month or two out. But a movie is a, you know, 2 hour contained experience. This is, you know, about a 7 to 8 hour series experience. I don't know if maybe that was why, but I was curious if the two of you had any struggles compiling your list, or perhaps I'm alone on Peridia with this one. So.
This was very hard for me to narrow it down. And I feel like part of that is because it was very easy for me to come up with an initial five, like a knee-jerk reaction five. Well, obviously it's these five. And then I kept thinking of more and more and making it more and more complicated for myself. And then it became a problem. The other thing, too, was I think it was really hard not to just pick multiple moments from particular episodes that I really love. Mm. I'm not going to say which ones because that might spoil what moments might be on my list. But that was the hard thing, too. I'm like, well, I can't pick three things from this one episode. That seems unfair.
Oh, man. No, it was difficult for me. Probably not in the same way as you, Carl. I had like my top three pretty well set already, but it was filling out the rest of it that I was having a problem with. So I was like, well, what about this one? Well, what about that one? And it was like, but do I like this moment over here better than this one? And it, you know, there was so much in like that second layer that I was like, I don't know. So I told Carl this. I finally went back to my notes that I took for the episodes that we did a few months back on Ahsoka, just to see what I wrote down about each of those episodes. I was like, ah, yes, that's what I'm going to pick. So I finally narrowed it down, and I got a list of five. But yeah, it was a bit difficult just to round it out. And I did run into a similar problem, Jen, with like, I've got a couple of these from one episode, and I ended up just being okay with that. So there is some extra representation of a couple of episodes in my list over others. So, but I was like, well, it's still my favorite moments, so I'll go with it. But, you know, everyone develops their own lists differently. So,
yeah.
Do you prioritize your heart or good content? It's a choice you have to make.
I'll say this, when I finished putting my list together, and I even said this to Jason when we hopped on the call this evening, I just said, you know, Jason, this is my current top five, but I could probably have a totally different five in 6 months from now. That's the thing that also kind of excites me. So, you know, these things are always malleable. They're not set in stone. So I'm excited to get into these. So, you know what, Jason, I'll invite you to go first, if you don't mind.
Sure, absolutely. So the first one that's on my top five list, my number five, if you will, is the breaking out of Morgan Elsbeth. And of course, it's the first thing that we get in the show. It's the opening sequence with Baylan and Shin storming on board the New Republic prison ship to break, you know, Morgan Elsbeth out. Self-explanatory. the whole, it really helped to set the tone for a lot of the challenges that we were going to have to face in this series. Great introduction to two of the coolest characters to come from the show. So I absolutely loved it. The music, the visuals, the characterizations of Baylan and Shin as they're just creating mayhem and chaos on board the New Republic ship. I thoroughly enjoy this moment, this scene, and it's very easy for me to just start playing it in my head when the track comes up on the soundtrack when I'm listening to it. So I absolutely love this scene.
Yeah. I will reserve comment on that because I also really enjoy this scene. So, Jen, unless you're bringing this up yourself later, do you have anything commentary on Jason's number five here?
So I do not have this on my list, but I will just say that it's one of the best introductions to new characters I think I've seen in a very long time in Star Wars. And like perfect combination of intrigue of like, you're like, wait, who are these people? Like, what is going on? But then also they're just so in command of the whole situation, right? When Baylan says like, oh, we're not Jedi. Like, you know,
right.
I wish he had delivered the line the way you just said that, Jen. Oh, we're not Jedi. Like, kind of like,
yeah. Like, that's cute that you would think that.
Yeah. Yeah,
but yeah,
a combination of intrigue, being in command, and it's just freaking cool. So.
It is. Yeah.
It is very cool. Yeah. And a great connective moment for those fans coming that for whom The Mandalorian is like their home base series, right? To have that character be where we start, I think was very smart.
Good point.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to give my number five next, because Jen, I want you to finish off the episode since you're the biggest Ahsoka fan of the lot of us. So the first one I wanted to mention, so my number five is Baylan versus Ahsoka round one. So this is from part four. Oh, shoot. Why did I forget the title of that episode? Fallen Jedi. There we go. It's from Fallen Jedi. And I think what I really enjoy about the fight, just the choreography of the fight itself, felt very prequel informed with a mix of sequel trilogy. I remember one of the Making of Force Awakens documentaries we got on the Blu-ray bonus. They talked a lot about how they wanted to change up the lightsaber combat from both the prequels and the originals. They wanted to give it a little bit of strength and rawness, especially with somebody like Adam Driver, you know, being able to play the part. And I feel like we get that with Baylan a lot. Baylan is very, very powerful. The types of strikes he's throwing at Ahsoka. I mean, but Ahsoka is very much a prequel Jedi because that's where she was trained. So she's got a little bit of that flourish and finesse, whereas Baylan has elements of that, but he also really relies on his brawn. And the other thing I also really enjoy is when he first ignites his lightsaber, the sound of it sounds very much like Darth Vader's lightsaber being ignited in Empire Strikes Back. So I just appreciated that kind of sound design similarity. And then also coming into the fight, what makes the fight so impactful to me, and this is where I always think, you know, the best lightsaber duels are the ones that have kind of an emotional investment, is Baylan is actually fighting for something. Ahsoka is kind of fighting to prevent something. She's not quite as dedicated to the fight as Baylan. Baylan is fighting with this purpose of a brighter tomorrow, as he tells Ahsoka before they start fighting. You know, he doesn't want to fight her. This is not the way he wants it to go. She kind of forces his hand. She draws on him first. She strikes first. Baylan is very much the defender in a sense. Once those blades are swinging, he has a far greater purpose, I would argue, than Ahsoka in this moment. He's really, really driven, and I think that also gives him the edge in the fight. And as they're fighting, he's forcing Ahsoka to grapple with something that she clearly has not resolved, which is her relationship with Anakin and the legacy that Anakin left. And of course, to me, like, I love a good Star Wars scene that gives us a big question. So it's obviously revealed that Baylan knows who Anakin became. So just for poo-doo and giggles, I ask the two of you, my friends, how do you think Baylan knows? How does Baylan know that Anakin is Darth Vader?
Well, he says later on in the show to Shin that he watched the Jedi Temple burn. And so the implication is that he was there, perhaps. So he may have seen Anakin storming the temple. He may not know specifically that Anakin became Darth Vader, but he definitely knows Anakin turned on the Jedi.
My theory might be slightly crackpot, and I don't even know if I believe this, but
I love it.
Crack all of our pots, Jen.
To me, if we pair Baylan's conversation with Ahsoka with the one that he has with Sabine, to me, it almost feels like one of his force powers is sort of dredging up the psychological baggage of his opponent. Ooh. And in kind of almost kind of like a telepathic kind of way. Yeah. And so to me, it almost read like he may not have known that before they encountered each other, but he was using his force ability to sort of mine that information from her and use it against her. Because I feel like there's just mirror image to me between his strategy, like psychological warfare strategy with Ahsoka versus with Sabine. And, you know, whether or not I want to call that like an official force ability or something like that, obviously that's not my place to say. But to me, that's what seemed to be the common thread between the two fights between the two encounters that they have, right? Is that he's so good at like needling both of those characters with like cutting right to the quick of like, this is the thing that is going to get you really upset and kind of distract you so that I can win this fight.
I like that. Because, you know, in an earlier episode, when they escape Corellia with the hyperdrive, Morgan asks him, well, Baylan, what do you see? And he's like, you know, her determination is, I forget the exact quote, but her determination is unwavering, you know, so she's coming. That makes sense. You know, he definitely, part of his skill set is being able to sense the thoughts, the emotions, the motivations, if you will, of people, probably both to their benefit and their detriment. So
sister.
Sort of like if Freud were a Jedi, I feel like that's how
yeah.
He'd be very dangerous.
So you have a twin sister, right? It's very Vader from Return of the Jedi. I love that, Jen. I've never heard that theory before, and I really, really enjoy it. It could be a little bit of column Jen, right? He could have been there, witnessed something, and then that gives him that edge to look into Ahsoka. Love it. So, Jen, what is your number five?
So my number five is from part six, and it is, you know, it's an entire scene, but really for me, it goes down to one line that Shin has, and it's when they arrive on Peridia and they meet the three Dathomiri witches for the first time in that sort of like triangle formation, and she just leans over and says, "More witches?" And to this day, that's one of my favorite lines. It just cracks me up every time because she's like, again with these witches, like, what is happening?
I hope you say that to children when they come trick-or-treating at your house, Jen, in the future. More witches?
Oh, that's a great idea. Yes, more witches. And you know, you could tell it really freaks her out. And, you know, obviously, like, the line to me is very funny. But to me, that is part of what makes the series as a whole so successful as a new entry into Star Wars canon. And it is the sort of use of more fantasy elements and the, you know, reappropriation of Dathomir and the witches and the Night Sisters, right? All that sort of stuff that we had in the Clone Wars and kind of like really repurposing it in this entirely different context in this series and really expanding the lore too, right? Like which is a very classic Dave Filoni thing to do, where he's constantly trying to push the boundaries of like, okay, what is the actual lore mythology of Star Wars? And so I feel like this scene is very representative of that to me, and is like so much why I love this series maybe more than some of the other ones, like, or this is like my personal favorite, because it has those fantasy elements and really pushes the boundaries of what we think of as the Force and what we think of as sort of like part of Star Wars. So that's more witches. I am not complaining. More witches, I guess.
And we might get some new types of witches in the Acolyte, apparently. Right. So that'll be crazy.
Right.
But yeah.
Witch train is not stopping anytime soon.
Apparently not. But no, I love that. That's great. Sometimes it really is just the little moments that just catch you just right. And there's no rhyme or reason as to why they catch you just right. But yeah, that's a great pick. I love that so much. We're on to number four, aren't we?
We sure are.
Well, I'm going to do a copy and paste real quick, because my number four is the Baylan versus Ahsoka part one fight.
So is mine.
Perfect.
So I won't say too much more about this because we've talked a lot about it already, but I really do enjoy this fight. It's really well choreographed. I love the visual dynamic that we have between Ahsoka, who's definitely very much more samurai styled in the way that her choreography is, where Baylan is more of a like a broadsword, like a classic knight sort of style in the way that his choreography is designed. I think having that pitted together is really, really cool visually. Plus, it also helps to convey the characters through their style and through their actions as well. It's also really great to see Ahsoka pull some moves that we would have seen in the Clone Wars or Rebels throughout the series, but also in this duel. So, and obviously she's definitely more samurai inspired in that as well. But speaking to what Carl said earlier, Baylan is definitely the stakes are higher for him in this fight, and he's more willing to stop it, to do anything to stop Ahsoka than Ahsoka is to stop him. And that's part of why the duel ends the way it does. Baylan never, he has flashes of emotion, but he never seems out of control in this fight, which I think Ahsoka ends up out of control by the end of it. And I think that's one of the big differences between these two and why the duel ended the way it did. And it's just very well done, extremely well choreographed, and it furthers the story in addition to being just freaking awesome. So, those are my thoughts, and we'll continue on.
Why don't, Jen, if that's your number four, why don't we just roll into your comments on it as well?
Great. Yeah. So, I mean, I spoke spoke earlier about sort of Baylan's masterful taunting game, like A+, no notes. I have no notes for him. He's the best, one of the best taunters in Star Wars, probably. And to add to sort of what Jason was saying about why the fight ends up the way it does, I think it's also because he succeeds in getting in her head, right? Like, it's working. Like, the stuff he's saying is working. And so the quote that I have that specifically sort of draws me to this moment is when he says, "Your legacy, like your master's, is one of death and destruction." And that line is so powerful to me because, one, it's like not really wrong. You know what I mean? There's some truth to it. And it is such a perfect setup. Like, if I'm putting my writer's hat on, like, it's a perfect setup for what we get in the next episode, right? The entire struggle of Ahsoka with Anakin in the world between worlds is she's trying to reckon with her past as being a child soldier and sort of being responsible for so much death and destruction, and really being like, well, how can I be a hero if this is my past, right? If this is how I was trained and this is where I come from. And it really does feel like Baylan's comment here is what sort of catalyzes that process of like of confronting that part of her past that has never been resolved, I think, or at least that's what we see in the flashbacks in episode 5. So yeah, that's what to me is what's so powerful, is that everything Jason said is, and you too, Carl, like, is absolutely correct in terms of it's beautifully choreographed. It's one of, as a fight, as a piece of fight choreography, it's incredible, but it's even more incredible because layered on top of it is all this storytelling, right? It's doing so much at the same time. It's multitasking in a lot of ways, which is what you need when you have a series that's only this many episodes, I think.
I would have loved if she flew into the fight like she does in the Rebels episode when she first attacks the Inquisitors to defend Kanan and Ezra. She just comes flying like a superhero. If only she had done that to Baylan. Well, missed opportunity.
She does kind of charge at him,
that's
what
true,
I remember.
She does. She's also a different person. It's a different time period.
Yeah. But she does have kind of like a ferocity and an anger that we don't often see her have when she's fighting other people.
She's also a decade older now than she was in Rebels. So, you know, maybe the flying,
it's hard on her knees.
Yeah, exactly.
She's refined her technique.
Yeah
exactly.
Well, I'll interject my number four because it actually goes very well with kind of where you set us up, Jen, with where we then go into, because it comes from part 5, The Shadow Warrior. And I'm cheating a little because it's not a solitary moment in so much as I'm just calling it Anakin's lesson. And I think a lot of it is summed up with, you know, it's funny because we've all called them flashback scenes, but if you think about it, they're actually not flashbacks. This is just kind of like a vision she's having. She goes back into the past, but it's not an actual flashback, because a flashback would imply that we're just in a moment from the past. And this, I mean, as soon as she shows up on the ground there, she's like, this is the Clone War. I don't think she said that back then. You know, and a lot of it has to do with just, I love Ariana Greenblatt as young Ahsoka. I think she just nails it. It's just such a perfect incarnation of Ashley Eckstein, in a way that I don't think Rosario quite ever landed. But that's my opinion. I think she's great, but I still feel like there's a small separation. All that to say, to me, and I remember asking you this, Jen, when we were hanging out in LA a couple months ago, I just said, you know, Jen, can you tell me what Anakin's lesson is? Because I still struggle to understand it. And it's such a driving force of part five. And, you know, when this episode first came out, I loved it just for the sense of like, it was a beautiful, brilliant episode. But I also felt it was a little abrupt. Like there was nothing in the previous four episodes that set up Ahsoka either one, not really having the will to live or not having the will to move forward or struggling with her master's legacy. So it just felt a little abrupt to me. But all that to say, I think Anakin's lesson, what she's clearly grappling with is, where does she come from? She was trained to be a child soldier, and that is her legacy as a Jedi. So I think Anakin's lesson is really profound in the first point to me, because he's proud of her. I think that's really part of what the lesson is too, is that he's proud of what he trained her to be. And I don't think he is delighting in the fact that he taught her to be a child soldier. But you know, I've talked about this line a couple of times in previous episodes, Jason, so forgive my repeating, but when he says to her, you know, we must adjust to the times, I've always loved that line, that for Anakin, when the Clone Wars start, Anakin sees himself as malleable. Like, I think he enjoys the war probably more than he ought to. But at the same time, what he really wants to impart to his Padawan is how to survive it. And the best way to do that is to teach her how to be a soldier. So I think he's proud of what Ahsoka grew into. You know, I also love the lesson that she's more than that legacy. You're more than that because I'm more than that. You know, I love the Hayden Christensen is just so freaking good in this episode. If only somebody besides George was directing young Hayden. I love George, but we all know he's not an actor's director. I think Hayden has shown in some of these recent series that he actually can act. But I love that what he is in part, he's also trying to give her the space to forgive what he became, maybe to also give her the grace of recognizing it wasn't in any way her fault. So for me, I love his lesson of giving her a sense of being proud of who you are and knowing that you are more than just this one part. Like, yes, you were part of a clone war. You were part of a war, but that's not all that you were. And he's trying to help her be proud of what he taught her to become. So I love all of this stuff. But yeah, so that is my number four. And I don't know if either of you have this point to make later on, but as always, I'm happy to hear what other folks think about Anakin's lesson, if you will.
This was my hardest cut. So it is not on my list, but it was at one point when I was trying to make my list. and I took it out partially because I knew someone else was going to, I was like, surely someone else will have this on their list. So I felt okay. In that sense, I felt okay cutting it. But to me, episode five is my favorite episode. I think it is where the series both reaches a narrative climax and I might say peaks in terms of like it reaches its highest height in that episode in terms of the storytelling. And to me, when I talked to lots of people after the episode aired, I could tell a lot of people were like, sort of a similar reaction to yours, Carl, where it was like, that was amazing. What did it mean? and this idea that like so I do think that in terms of the writing, the themes were a little too subtle, a little too obtuse. Part of that is because it's the world between worlds, right? So it's supposed to be surreal and right, like it's like, you know, a fever dream kind of feeling. And so I think that was part of the motivation for why it is the way it is and like why it doesn't like sort of hold your hand to be like, this is what you were supposed to take away from this. But if I go back to my review that I wrote right after the episode aired, this is what I wrote. And like, I'm rereading this kind of for the first time too, so this will be fun. The key to understanding the whole world between worlds sequence is to acknowledge that the lesson Anakin teaches Ahsoka is not literally to live or die, though that is sort of what he says, but rather to learn what it takes to choose to live. Through two powerful nostalgia-packed flashbacks, which are not really flashbacks, I agree. It's more of a Christmas Carol situation, as well as the intense, I can't do a Hu Yang accent, but conversations Anakin and Ahsoka have during them, Ahsoka learns that choosing to live means accepting your mistakes. Even if they come at a great cost, these follies should not paralyze you, stop you from trying to lead and do what's right. So it really is kind of a reckoning and being like, kind of like, just get over it. Pep talk, yeah. As all good teachers can give. But yeah, so that's sort of, that's my interpretation of it.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about this is, and he says something about, I don't remember the exact line off the top of my head, but he says something about, I taught you to survive. And that goes directly back into the lesson he was teaching in the Tales of the Jedi shorts. That we had with Ahsoka and Anakin, you know, that was what he drilled into her, is like, I'm not always going to be there to protect you. You need to be able to survive on your own. And now it's become something like, this isn't just about survival anymore. This is about living again. And I like what you said about that, Jen, because this is, you know, the survivalist who has had to make it through a panoply of terrible circumstances can't just be stuck in place by those circumstances anymore. She's got to find a reason, find a motivation, find it within herself, or without, if, you know, motivated by, you know, Sabine and, you know, the new people that she's interacting with now, to have the reason to live again. And I do like that distinction. It's not about literally living. It's about what it takes to be alive again. And I think that's really good. The lesson didn't make it into my list. I'll have something about this whole sequence later on in my list, but doesn't have anything to do with this. But yeah, so I'm glad we got to talk about it here now explicitly. And I do appreciate the question, Carl, because it is one of those things like, that was amazing. What did we learn? You know, and I think it was also one of the situations where they may have tried a little bit too hard to make it like the tree on Dagobah, the cave on Dagobah in Empire Strikes Back. Kind of, which is very open-ended, and there's various ways to interpret that.
I don't think it's that open-ended, to be honest. Like, it's kind of clear.
Maybe not open-ended, but there's various flavors of how you can interpret that one. Sure. You know, but yeah, I think this one in particular, they may have tried a little bit too hard on that, but it still came through in the end. I think it's one of those great things because it gives everyone a discussion point to come together and be like, what did we think? And I think that was also part of the point of it. So.
Yeah.
If there are different ways to interpret it, at the end of the day, it is honoring the master Padawan relationship between Anakin and Ahsoka really well. And this is the whole series, I would say. Like, I think that's one of its greatest strengths, is it really shows that it has a deep understanding of their relationship.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and I would say, you know, part five is also very much the Empire Strikes Back episode of the series with its ending and. This is the Force Cave experience without as clear a sensibility as to why it's happening. But yeah, so anyway, Jason, we are to your number three then.
Yes, number three. This is going to be from part six, Far, Far Away. And this is probably going to be my sort of out of left field pick. But it's the scene where Baylan and Shin are talking shortly after landing on Peridia, and she's asking what's wrong. And he's like, you know, this is a land of dreams of madness where children's stories come to life. And that phrasing and sort of the culmination of what it all means to Baylan by the end of the conversation, because, you know, she's asking, is this where, you know, this is where we make our stand. This is where, this is what we're here for, right? And he says, well, if the stories are true, if the old stories are true, this is Balin's hope. Like, he's been so, you know, I feel like he's been very cynical, you know, and kind of closed off. But being able to come to this place and seeing that it exists and the way it exists is finally giving him hope and for what his goals are. And of course, we get a look into those in the epilogue. But this is where we really kind of get to see him start to think and to dream about, you know, what his role in all of this is and where he might be in the not too distant future. And the, you know, to put an end to the cycle, as he says, and the idea that he is here in this land of dreams and madness where children's stories come to life. This sort of is resurrecting that old, like, the fairy tale is real or more real than I thought. And I love that. I love that so much because it is sort of to me, it's a bit of a meta thing going on with Star Wars. It's like, you know, how close can Star Wars get to being a real fairy tale kind of thing? And, I love that sort of that playing with stories. Because I think, you know, stories are one of my favorite ways that we have communicated as humanity throughout time. So the fact that we're sort of still playing with them and the even the old stories, the fairy tales, have their strength, have their basis in a reality in this world, and might actually be true. You know, giants and goblins might actually exist out there, you know, kind of a situation, you know, to a lesser extent than what Balin is dreaming. But I love this scene and I love the themes that he's dealing with in this. And that's why this scene is my number three. So
when I was compiling my list, I was like, if I'm being honest with myself, if really wanted to be real, probably Shin and Balin parts of this series would probably honestly make up most of my top five because they are my favorite part of the show. But this is one of those scenes I didn't put it on there simply because I was like, no, don't give all your stuff to Bennett, Shin and Balin. I love this though, Jason, and I love what you're saying and this whole line of, you know, this is, you know, legends and of children tales and what have you.
Yeah.
I mean, the very episode begins with Su Yang saying the thing, right?
Yes, I don't know that a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
I don't know if I ever needed to hear that in Star Wars spoken, but be that as it may, this story is very much about the reality of myths and fables. And, you know, to your point, Jason, I think for Balin, he is so close now to seeing something become real. Almost as if whatever, you know, I love the folks over at Star Wars Explained, and they often, with all of their recaps, Alex was always saying, like, what the heck is Balin after? And I do think that is, obviously, we know there's going to be another season, and I really hope that, you know, it is so sad that we lost Ray Stevenson, but I do really hope that they continue the character with somebody else. So that we can learn more about that, because I am right there with Alex from Star Wars Explained that was something that was sorely lacking in this season, is giving more exposition as to what exactly is driving Balin. And I get it. We don't have to have all the points painted out, but my goodness, give us more. All that to say though, Jason, like, I love what you're saying, because whatever has been driving Balin, maybe he has always seen it as kind of this myth and fairy tale. He's aware that possibly he can break this cycle through these gods on Peridia, these Mortis gods, if you will. He's aware of something bigger than the Jedi, and that's what he's after. So now that he's here and he has seen this myth come to life, how much more real do his dreams now seem? And I love that element of what's going on here.
I would agree that my one critique of the series is sort of in how it ended. specifically with Baylan and Shin's storyline, because it really seemed like we spent so much time building up to something and then we didn't even get like a tease of it. Like I would have taken, you know, Baylan. So the interesting thing is we do get, you know, the statue of the father pointing, right? And that's huge, right? But that's our understanding of what Baylan could be after, right? That's what that hints at, what could be on Perdia. But at no point do we hear from Baylan himself what he's after, right? He kind of makes these like vague and oblique like hints that he's after something. But I really was hoping that by the end of the season, we would end with sort of a cliffhanger of like, he's sort of like, you know, for the first time tells Shin like why he's actually there and what he's actually trying to do, right? What his actual ulterior motive is. Cause it's so clear the whole time that he has an ulterior motive that he's like, oh yeah, sure. Thrawn's going to start a war, whatever. Right. Like he's, you know, these witches, whatever. Right. Like he's just like, everyone could do their own thing. I have this very specific agenda. All of this was a way to get me here. And so the fact that we don't really learn what here to him is, I think, is just not satisfying in terms of like episodic storytelling for it to end a season of a series like this. But that said, I feel like I agree with you that inevitably, if they try to rewrite whatever they were planning based on not having Ray Stevenson, I feel like that's going to inevitably dilute whatever what was about to happen. And so, yeah, I agree that I really hoped, as painful as it will be to see someone else in that role, I really do hope that they try to maintain the integrity of the story they thought they were going to end up telling. So.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. Yeah. It is going to be painful, but I don't see a way, because the way that it's set up is that whatever Baylan is after is going to be the main crux of the next season. You know, season one is we got to try and the objective of season one is to get, you know, Ahsoka to a place where she's overcome her hangups about Anakin and she's accepted her place in the galaxy again, and to get Thrawn back into the galaxy at large. That was the objective of season one. Season two, which we've got hints about, is going to be whatever it is Baylan's up to.
Maybe
that seems to be that's the way I read it anyway. Is that's the way they were setting the story up. So I, in order to keep that story going, like you said, Jen, as painful as it will be, I think they have to recast. You know, otherwise it's just not going to be as satisfying or impactful, by far. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that scene, Jason. So thanks for bringing it in. So my number three is from the first episode, Master and Apprentice, and it's when Sabine unlocks the orb. Part of my love of orbs just increased because of Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. And there's also a delightful orb in that movie. Not as well written of a movie as perhaps some things in Ahsoka, but it's still fun as hell. All that to say, I love when Sabine unlocks this orb. And I will admit, one of my favorite parts of the scene is simply the music. Again, you know, as we talked a few weeks ago with Ashton when he came on to talk about the music of Ahsoka, I think this has one of the best Star Wars scores also in the Disney era. I mean, I think Kevin Kiner has been crushing it since the Clone Wars, so no reason that he wouldn't even elevate his game for a show like this. But I love this so much because I also find it sort of intriguing that part of how Sabine is able to unlock the orb and unlock in the map itself is almost using what Thrawn was first known for in Legends canon, which is studying art. Sabine is the one they bring it to. Hu Yang and Ahsoka and Hera all agree, hey, who's our kind of artistic expert? Well, that's Sabine. Let's take it to Sabine. So she's almost employing what Thrawn did all throughout the Heir to the Empire trilogy. And when she unlocks it in the company of her adorable cat, you know, we have this this beautiful moment of what I'm calling her. It's a balcony scene. I love balcony scenes. And it's also her binary sunset scene. This is her call to adventure, to use Campbellian terms. And Jen, correct me if I'm wrong in that. You're much brighter than I am about these things. But all that to say, I mean, I love as she runs out onto that balcony and she looks up into, you know, the infinite expanse. This is such a Star Wars scene. You know, I love these moments in all of our characters where they're looking beyond themselves to their purpose. And for Sabine, her deepest hope here is, oh my gosh, maybe I will actually be reunited with Ezra. This is her emotional draw throughout the series, especially the first part of the series. So I really, really love that this is what this scene really encapsulates is when we first meet Sabine earlier in the episode, she's kind of chosen this more reclusive life, but the hope and the promise of being reunited with someone she loves so dearly is going to spring her into action. And quite literally, that's what happens next. She springs into action in this great fight sequence. But yeah, her unlocking the orb is one of my favorite moments in this series.
And her knowledge of art and culture is a huge part of Rebels too, right? I think. And so I feel like carrying that over, I think, was such a nice thing to do for Rebels fans, because it was like the whole arc of her and Thrawn, and also like has a little shorthand in terms of like, well, this is why a story about Thrawn has to include Sabine and vice versa, right? Is because they have this past relationship and of almost mutual respect from what I remember, right? Like Thrawn really likes Sabine because she has this appreciation for art. I feel like, and in general, you know, this connects back to what Jason was saying with the dreams and madness idea and the fairy tale idea, because it's sort of like weaponizing, like Thrawn's version of it is like learning about myth and learning about culture, learning about the folklore of something in order to weaponize it, right? And to leverage it. Whereas Sabine, right, in contrast, presumably does it out of just a love of art and creativity.
Yeah, good point.
It's a great scene, and it's the first time we get the that sort of call to adventure music that we have talked about on the show several times, Carl. So
yeah,
any scene with that music is always a good scene.
Sure is. Jen, what is your number three?
So my number three, I didn't actually look up what episode this was from. I think it's from Time to Fly Part 3. But it's when Sabine, Ahsoka, and Hu Yang kind of go into action mode. And there's a line specifically that Ahsoka says where she says, "I don't need Sabine to be a Jedi. I need her to be herself." And then Hu Yang's response is, "Well, you do come from a long line of non-traditional Jedi, right?" And to me, I love the sequence for two reasons. One is because it is the first time we see Ahsoka really light up. And I feel like this was the first time I felt like, quote unquote, old Ahsoka was back. Because I know, like, I had a hard time with the characterization of her as being kind of dour, crossing her arms constantly. Like, I was with everybody else in that. I was like, I'm gonna wait and see. But like, this doesn't feel like Ahsoka to me, even though my brain was rationalizing it as like, well, it makes sense because of all these other things that are happening and like where she is in her life and whatever. And inevitably, you know, as we all get older, the characters get old that we love get older. And if we want to sustain a story over many, many decades, we're going to have to deal with sort of like the midlife crisis versions of all these characters. And so it made sense to me, but I still felt a certain way about it. But this scene was the first time I was like, we're back. Like, Ahsoka is back. Like, this is the Ahsoka that I have known for a long time. And so I love it for that reason. But then I also love it because the exchange that I just quoted really digs deep into Ahsoka's history as a character, right? And really her what defines her and what sets her apart from a lot of other Jedi characters, right? That she broke with the Jedi Order. And I think, like, what gets lost in the shuffle a little bit is that when she showed up in The Mandalorian and even in this series, everybody is still calling her a Jedi. I don't think that's what she would call herself, right? Like, if, you know, knowing her history and that she left the Jedi Order, like, I think she would characterize herself as a Force user, but not necessarily a Jedi. Because to her, Jedi means the institution that betrayed her and that let her down, right? And so I love that Hu Yang's response is like, well, you do come from a long line of non-traditional Jedi, because it really, like, references her past and her history and how that really has defined her as a character.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And Jen, well, Jason, you've met Ben too, our mutual friend, Ben, the king of all gonks. I remember this was one of the first moments that I remember him being particularly excited about, where he just pointed out, you know, oh, I enjoy that. What Ahsoka is not trying to do is train her to be a Jedi. But she's using her own Jedi training to train her as something beyond herself. And Jason and I were just talking about this earlier this evening. I finally sat down and watched last week's Bad Batch. Nothing like almost being a week behind, Carl. But slight spoiler if you're not up to date with Bad Batch, but this is very minor. But there's a beautiful scene where Omega is teaching Crosshair how to meditate, because she was taught by Gunji in season two. So it's right. Omega is not a Jedi. Well, she obviously has ability to receive M count, but all that aside, she's not a Jedi. Crosshair certainly is no Jedi. So it's this beautiful moment, though, where we can take the lessons of a Jedi and apply them to anyone. So I love that for Ahsoka, she's taking her own skill set, her own knowledge, and passing that on to Sabine so that Sabine can become the most full version of herself. And for Hu Yang then to also just point out, well, you know, everything you're part of, this tradition you're part of, is non-traditional. So it would make sense that you would continue the tradition of non-tradition. So, yeah, what a great moment.
Yeah, no, it is great. And I do love the fact that she says, I'm not training her to be a Jedi. I'm training her to be, you know, her full self. I just need her to be her, you know. I don't need her to be a Jedi. I need her to be herself, because it all, you know, obviously the beginning of this series, neither Sabine nor Ahsoka are quite themselves, you know, anymore. And this season is about them becoming who they fully are again. And maybe that's part of why they don't mesh, even, you know, mesh quite right anymore, is because, you know, neither of them are fully who they should be at this point. And it takes a bit of friction and a bit of challenge to knock them back into those proper spots. But yeah, I love that. So,
yeah. Well then, Jason, we bring it to your number two.
Number two. All right. Here we go. We're going to dive into part five, Shadow Warrior. And number two, my favorite parts of the World Between Worlds sequence in this episode are the flashes of Vader. You know, we only get it twice, really. You know, we get it after the conversation in the triage center after the battle. That first battle of the Clone Wars that we see, when they're marching back into the fray and the explosion happens and we get Anakin flashing into Darth Vader. And then as they get knocked out, as, you know, Anakin knocks Ahsoka out of the vision and back into the World Between Worlds proper, his crossing over from one phase to the other also flashes Vader. And I think it's great because not only is it, you know, it's obviously very cool, it's very well done, but it's incredibly good for the story, because this is what Ahsoka is struggling with. The who Anakin became and how that and what that means for who she is the crux on which everything that Anakin is trying to teach her is hanging. And so the fact that we get it and we get it in this way, and I was thinking about it in preparation for today's episode, it's almost like it's PTSD flashes for Ahsoka. Like it's, you know, whether or not it actually happens, quote unquote, in the world between worlds, it doesn't really matter, because the way that Anakin is doing things and the way that everything is coming in around her, it's triggering something that almost feels like a PTSD reaction to Ahsoka. And so she's seeing it, whether or not it's actually happening that way or not, doesn't really matter. And I think it's great because then ultimately she's able to overcome it. But the storytelling and the way it's done, the way it's shot, and the editing of it all with Hayden's gait, both as Anakin and as Vader, as it flashes together, it's seamless and it's intricately well done. And I absolutely love it for all of the above reasons. So I don't have much more to say because it's just a small snippet of the greater whole. And we've already talked about a lot of what's going on in there, but it's those moments, they're the punctuation marks that we get to everything that's happening in this vision sequence for Ahsoka. And it sort of, you know, it's almost as if she's starting to settle into whatever this vision is. It shakes her up again and it stirs it back up. And, you know, after the first one, we go to a different place in the Clone Wars. And after the second one, it's when she is faced with having to make the decision in order to go back and to live. So, I love those moments. The flashes of Vader.
Yeah.
They're also just genuinely very scary.
Like, yes, absolutely. They caught me off guard.
Like a horror film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Caught me completely off guard the first time I watched it. So absolutely.
I love when Hayden says, "Is that what this is about?" His Canadian comes out. I love it so much. The way he says about, it's so Canadian. I mean, it's not literally a boot, but it's like, ooh, there's that Canadian Hayden.
But yeah, also, a little bit creeps in, yeah.
Yeah, but also just, you know, the brilliant sound design or when he says, "You lack conviction," right? In the way they kind of play the Vader effect over his line delivery there. It's just really, really brilliant. And, Jason, you're spot on, I would say, with, like, these are flashes of PTSD. I believe it's season two, the opening of Rebels season two, with that two-part series where Ahsoka senses Vader and his TIE interceptor, and she just, I mean, she goes unconscious. She's so overwhelmed by it that she blacks out. She's never, and we get little pieces of her trying to make sense of this in Rebels, but she never quite does, until she encounters him on Malachor. So it is this, like you said, this is what's torturing her. It's still what's with her. And for Anakin, because Anakin is not that person anymore. Him being there in the world between worlds proves that he is no longer that person. But she is still haunted by it. So it's those flashes of Vader, going kind of off of what you're saying, Jason, to me, that's Ahsoka putting that onto him. I don't think that's him actually appearing that way. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, it's so, so good. And, you know, Jason, we talked about this a while ago, but obviously Ahsoka has met Luke at this point. She knows Luke starting a Jedi Academy, and we can assume that Luke probably told her that Anakin was redeemed. And, you know, it's one, Jason, you made this point months ago, but right, it's one thing to say something. It's another thing to experience it. You know, Luke, I mean, and even, you know, the novel Princess and the Scoundrel by Beth Revis is so good with this when Luke is talking to Leia about it. I mean, shortly after the Battle of Endor, and saying like, no, he came back. Leia just can't believe it and also doesn't want to, rightfully so. But yeah, all this stuff is playing in Ahsoka's head too, that for her, what she is still being haunted by is not so much that Anakin trained her to be a soldier, but what Anakin became. And that's, like you said, Jen, that's what Baylan used at the start of their fight to get at her too, is, you know, look who trained you. Look what he became. You're on the same path in his mind almost.
I was going to say, as you were talking about Rebels, that this fight seems like a really nice mirror image of Twilight of the Apprentice, because it's like she, because in that fight, it's like she's fighting Vader, but then towards as the fight unfolds, she keeps sensing and gets that little eye glimpse, right, of Anakin. And and I feel like it's so good. And so this is the opposite, where it's like it's Anakin that she's fighting, but she sees hints and flashes of Vader. The other thing too, I think, like you're describing sort of the sound work and the visualization of Anakin and Vader and how it's kind of flashing back and forth. And I feel like it's just a brilliant way to visualize the paradox that is Anakin and Vader, right? Like that, because to make sense of it cognitively, like we say, oh, Anakin, like Darth Vader killed Anakin Skywalker, right? Like that's the narrative that characters and we sort of like create to make sense of it, right? How can these two people be the same person? But I think this does a really good job of showing that like it's a both and situation, right? It's like, yes, like Darth Vader did kill Anakin when he turned to the dark side, but they both exist. And part of, I think, the thing that Ahsoka has to grapple with is just because Anakin became Vader doesn't negate the goodness that was in Anakin, right? And we get confirmation of that in the, I want to say next episode, they all kind of bleed together after a little while, but like I believe it's the beginning of the next episode where she has the training tape, like the hologram.
Part 7.
And then she says, he was a good master, right? And so that's the arc of that. That's the narrative resolution of the fight, where she's like really grappling with like, you know, oh, but he became Vader. So does that undo all the good that we did together, right? And then she decides that it doesn't.
Yeah. And I'm just going to, because you brought it up, Jen, I just want to steal this because I don't have it in my notes at all. But I do love that scene when she's watching the training video, and I love the way Rosario delivers the line too. She kind of just breathes in deeply. He was a good master, right? Like there's just this, she breathes in that goodness. And then in the finale, when she's talking to Sabine on top of the ship, and she says, Anakin always stood by me, even when no one else did, right? Like it has come full circle. She does remember the goodness that he was to her, you know, for so much of her experience of him, that he was, in fact, a really good master, and he cared about her deeply, especially at a time when everyone else was willing to sell her out. This is why Anakin is the greatest Jedi. He's better than the institution. All right, everybody's going to come at me now, but that's okay. I'm ready for it.
I'm not touching that.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, let's do. Okay, so I think we're up to my number two.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Well, my number two comes once again from part 5, Shadow Warrior, and it's towards the end of the episode, and it's the communing with the Purrgil. I love this for Ahsoka, and so much of it is Ahsoka once again entrusting herself to what I'm calling the living force. It's that aspect of the living force, the ability to touch another life form and have this intimate connection. And then to go into the belly of the beast, very Jonah-esque, you know, this is also an important part of the mythical storytelling elements that Campbell talks about all the time. But she goes into that with nothing but faith, nothing but trust. Because when Hu Yang says like, oh, good, they know how to get there. No idea. Like I love the way she even says it. No idea. Like it's so good. And it's like, as you were saying earlier, Jen, you know, we kind of start getting glimpses of the Ahsoka we've always known, not the brooding, I'm going to cross my arms for 30 minutes, Ahsoka. You know, it's that sense of optimism. That, I mean, that was so much of who Ahsoka was. And she's got that back now. And yes, in a new way, right? Like it's never good to revert to former versions of ourselves, but it is okay to go back to these elements that we may have lost and bring them into a new form of maturity. And I think for Ahsoka, she is just entrusting herself to the will of the Force here in such a profound way that she doesn't know exactly where she'll end up. And as she says to Hu Yang, well, I don't know where we're going, but it's better than going nowhere. And she just puts herself out there. It's so beautiful. And then the end of that episode, once again, just as I said with the orb piece, it's so much of this is also the music. Again, Kevin Kiner, the track is the Hyperspace Jump on the soundtrack, Volume 2. If you've not listened to this, do yourself a favor. It's so freaking good. But yeah. She entrusts herself. She takes us, the audience, with her. And this is, I think this is the episode where this is the moment where I fell in love with the show in a very profound way, because it's like, yes, this is the story about finding your faith again. And that can mean whatever it will to you. But as she finds her faith, it has this ripple effect, because I love as the Pergiller flying through. I also love how they call it the fleet. It's three ships, but this is probably why the New Republic didn't do very well. Their fleets are tiny. but as they're flying through and we get these beautiful shots of the pilots and they're all, you know, we have these looks of kind of like confusion, almost maybe a little bit of fear. But then we end with Carson Tava. God, are we so lucky to have him in this, in these series. And he just grinned so big. You know, it's so beautiful. And it's, there's this sense of awe and wonder once again in Star Wars. And, you know, these are the things that draw me to Star Wars. So I love this aspect. So Ahsoka's faith and trust also elicits the sense of wonder and awe in the galaxy once again. And it takes us as the audience forward with that. And I love that so much.
So in my review, I believe, of episode one that I wrote right after I saw it, the phrase that I used was follow the Lothcat, because in Rebels season 4, Ezra says something like, well, I'll always follow the Lothcat. And that's literally what he does in some of those final episodes, is that he's like, well, Lothcat's going this way. I wonder what's over here. And to me, that concept is sort of what you're describing, of just like letting go. Don't overthink it. Like, put your trust in the Force, in the universe. Right. And just go with it. And I feel like that was to me was what I thought, and what I thought was going to be the defining quality of this series, this idea of the magic and the wonder and the giving yourself over to the unknown, right? And just to see where it takes you, sort of that Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole kind of feeling. And I feel like that, one, that's a really good carryover from Rebels, because there was so much of that in Rebels, with like, it got really weird at the end, right? There were the Loth Wolves and like, yeah. You know, and the portals and all that sort of stuff. And so I love that this series is leaning so heavily into that, because to me, that's a really fundamental quality of Star Wars, is like the childlike wonder of it all.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. I'm going to save my thoughts on that scene for just a few more minutes. So Jen, what's your number two?
So my number two, yes, same. I probably shouldn't have even said what I just said. I ruined our later conversation. But my number two is when Ezra, who I feel like we haven't talked about a ton on these lists, Ezra building a new lightsaber using Kanan's old spare part. This was one of the most emotional scenes for me. I love Kanan so much as a character. You know, Rebels is one of my favorite Star Wars stories ever. And so to have this scene in here and have it, and I think it was one of the, I don't want to say few, but it was one of the times, and the show didn't always get this right, but it was one of the times where I felt like it worked perfectly both for both audiences of the show, the diehard fans who were going into this having seen all of Rebels and love and being really invested in that story and wondering how it was going to carry over into this one. But then also the more casual fans who were just coming into it, not having quote unquote done all that homework. Right. And I had so many people asking me before the show started, like, do I need to watch something before this? And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. there's so much, I don't know. But really, like, I feel like this scene works both ways, because like, you don't necessarily need to know Kanan to know the gravity of the scene. And Hu Yang in particular says the relationship between a master and an apprentice is as challenging as it is meaningful. And I feel like this is one of the core arguments of the series, right? Because of the struggle of Ahsoka and Sabine, right? They're falling out and trying to find a way to work together again. And then obviously the relationship between Kanan and Ezra, and how meaningful that ended up being. And to me, this just, and the fact that it's coming from Hu Yang, who's seen it all and has mm-hmm. has this kind of like ancient quality to him. I just thought was really beautiful.
Yeah.
And he's still 75% original parts. So
you know, oh my gosh, Jen, it's so funny. I just nixed this right before we started recording, but my favorite Ezra scene, and I'm mad at myself that I didn't keep it on the list, is actually in the previous episode. So in episode 7, when this is why I actually struggle with this. The moment you just mentioned is when he says to Sabine, I don't need a weapon. The Force is my ally. That's all I need. So it really bummed me out when the very first scene of the next episode is him building a lightsaber. I felt like that was really, really pathetic storytelling. It kind of walked us back rather than forward.
He's being really facetious when he says that, though.
Is he? I feel like he's being honest.
Or at least that's how he took it.
Cocky for sure. I mean, let's be honest. The only thing he's had to deal with are these bandits and Nodi for years. So he's on top of the game. He's on top of the world right now. And so, you know.
Yeah, fair.
Maybe, you know, now he's going to go up against Thrawn and all of his stormtroopers. So maybe a little extra, you know, a little extra something in the pocket isn't such a bad idea.
No, I also love it for the same reasons, Jen, because I love Kanan. And I love that there's that continuation of Kanan's legacy through Ezra. I will say one of my biggest hopes for season 2 is that Ezra takes Jason under his wing. I think that would just be so wonderful. But this is a great moment, and I think it's so important too, because Hu Yang highlights that importance of the relationship between the master and the apprentice, and that Ezra, in fact, is a good student because he listens. But my favorite Ezra moment across everything is just when he is so confidently saying, I don't need anything but the Force. And then it was so cool to watch him use the Force as his primary weapon, if you will. Like I just thought that was really cool. So it just kind of bummed me out when he was like, oh, well, now let me just build a lightsaber. I get it. And it makes for a much more exciting finale with the three of them wielding lightsabers as they storm the castle. So I absolutely get it. But I love that it's so important to you, Jen. That's really, really great. Always here for Kanan Jarrus.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also great because it's a symbolic sort of passing on the torch between Kanan and Ezra that we never really got. We never had the opportunity to get that because of what happens in Rebels. So it's like, well, we're finally getting to, you know, in this story in particular, we're getting, you know, Ezra sort of connected back into where he was before, what he's familiar with. But in terms of the larger story, the larger narrative with him, it's like we're wrapping up, we're putting a nice little conclusion on the story of him and Kanan, because they never got to have a conclusion, you know. And I think that was something that we saw Ezra struggle with in the last several episodes of Rebels. You know, he kind of gets a little bit of it with the Doom Wolf, if you will. But it's not quite the same. And so being able to take something like a piece of the saber that Kanan had, and he being the only other Jedi to have a saber like that, was a really great sort of passing of the torch, you know, passing the sword. It's the family crest being passed on, if you will, in a sense. And it not only is it great for Ezra in terms of the master apprentice relationship, but it's also sort of keeping it in the family and reestablishing the fact that Ezra is a part of this family, the Ghost Crew family. So,
yeah, I love that. Yeah, he really didn't have any time to grieve, right? Because of the urgency of the situation. And then he gets zapped away with the Purgle to Peridia. And then he's just like, well, I guess it's just me and all these Nodi. Like, and my thoughts alone for many years. And Star Wars has such a rich history of teachers and students. So I love the idea that Hu Yang isn't just throwing him any old part, but is like using his sort of history and his encyclopedic knowledge to be like, oh, Kanan Jarrus. Like, hey, there's some parts here, right? Like, and honoring sort of that legacy, and that would be meaningful to Ezra. I thought was really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
It sounds like the two of you have the same number one. So I'll let you, I'm going to share mine quick, and then, you know, I'll invite the two of you to talk a bit about what you want to talk about. So my number one is something I believe, Jason, you mentioned at the top of your list, which is Shin and Baylan showing up right at the beginning of the series. They're landing on the New Republic frigate. And it was a toss-up between this and the Ahsoka and the Pergil. And the reason I had to go with this, though, is because, like, this was, like, that first 2 minutes of the show, I was like, oh, my God, I already love this. In a way that no other, I mean, as much as I loved the opening of Mandalorian, like, not even that did what this did for me. And part of it is it's just such a cool play on the intro of Phantom Menace, right? We've got these two hooded characters showing up and then kicking some tail. Granted, maybe a little bit different why we're kicking tail. but I love this relationship between this master and this apprentice and their relentlessness. You know, they just show up and they're moving forward. Nothing is going to stop them. And I believe it was in a couple of the like interviews Ray Stevenson had been in before the show came out, where he described his character as someone who is relentless. And if you're in his way, on his way to his mission, he will brush you aside. You know, that he's not particularly a malicious character, but he's got a drive that will not stop him. And clearly the same is true for Shin, because their last time together, he says to Shin, you know, my path lies one way, your ambition leads in another. They're very ambitious characters. And eventually they get to the point where Baylan recognizes they're after different things. And he rightfully kind of allows them to part ways. Sad. But even right as the beginning, I think it just grabbed me. It grabbed me and sunk me into the show. And what I really appreciated was just like, oh, Star Wars is a fun adventure again. Thank you. I mean, this is coming off of, I mean, our last show was Andor, which was very much not that. Again, Andor is lots of brilliant things, but it is not a fun adventure. And so I loved just, that's where this show starts, is it starts with that aspect. And I think it also establishes that Baylan and Shin are a threat. You know, there are so many stories that exist nowadays where villains are just kind of introduced, but there's nothing particularly intimidating about them. And as much as I love Phantom Menace and Darth Maul, that is, to me, one of the glaring missteps of Phantom Menace, is that we're shown Darth Maul and, like, yes, he looks cool and he looks intimidating, but he doesn't do anything really until he duels them at the end of the movie. He doesn't do much. This is what I love here, is they show up and they show that they're a force to be reckoned with. They're scary. You know, they're going to forge ahead and nothing is going to stop them. So Baylan and Shin are also my favorite Disney Star Wars characters, except for Kanan. So I love the way they grabbed me. So that was my number one for this. But
that's awesome.
I really am excited to hear what the two of you have to say about Ahsoka and those Pergil.
yeah, it's not really much of a secret. That's my favorite scene. And I have said it multiple times, even like back when the episodes were airing, in episode 5, The Shadow Warrior, which is the same episode that we get, you know, all of this Anakin and Ahsoka interaction that we've been talking a lot about in this episode. Even on my first viewing, I told the friends I was watching this with, my favorite part was the Pergil scene. Because there is so much hope and so much uplifting about this, so much wonder and curiosity, and just we're going to trust this, you know, that this is the Force. We are stepping out in faith in the Force. You know, how do you know where they're going to take us? No idea. How do you know where they're going? No idea. You know, that you mentioned that, Carl. That is one of my favorite parts about all this. No idea. And she's totally excited and fine with it. You know, and the way it's, you know, it's shown as she's standing out on the edge of the ship, reaching out in the Force to the Pergil, much the way that Ezra would do in Rebels. and the fact that you know, it just, and the music and everything, it's shot beautifully, but it just gets into my pores, the feelings of this. It's to the point where I can't really describe the hope and the joy and the wonder that I'm experiencing in a way that I think is effective. So, and every time I watch it, I still get the same chills. I still get the same excitement. It is unshakably my favorite part of this show. And that's why it will forever be my number one. So, Jen, I want to hear why it's yours. So
the thing you're describing of, like, you can't quite put your finger on it, but it gives you this feeling, is, first of all, is exactly how I feel about this scene as well. It's like every time I watch it, it just makes me feel huge emotions. And I think the first time I saw it, I cried, and I was just, and it was really taken aback by it, and was like, what is going on? Like, why do I feel like this? And especially punctuated by when Hera says, "May the Force be with you," right? That's like, and
I'm getting chills just talking about it.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah, right. And it really is like, and that's so incredible because it is a phrase that we use so much. It's a phrase that's on bumper stickers, right? People are signing their emails with it. People have tattoos of it, right? It's a thing that almost has desensitized itself in some ways because it's a thing people say and it's a shorthand, and we don't usually, or at least I don't usually, stop to think about what's behind that phrase and how it should make me feel. Whereas this scene definitely does. In film theory, this sort of like amorphous emotion that's generated from watching something is called affect. And it's a thing in cinematic storytelling because it's like, you're not feeling the feelings you're feeling because you're identifying with the character. That would be different, right? If you're like, And I think that's true of this scene because Ahsoka is extremely at peace. Like, she's not like welling up. She's not a hot mess like I was when I was watching this, right? She's at peace. She has a lightness. She has a new sense of enlightenment. And so we're not feeling that with her. It's the fact that we're watching her go through that and watching her commune with the Purrgil that is making us feel all these sorts of things, right? And that's really powerful and very hard to do. And it's a combination of all the things, right? It's Rosario Dawson's expression on her face. It's the music. It's the fact that the Purrgil are so meaningful in Rebels, and the fact that they are just so majestic and representative of how the Force is, so much of the Force, of understanding the Force, is about understanding and harmonizing with nature, right? Mm. And like all this sorts of stuff is like really baked into this one moment. And it's incredible. Also, like, I just love the idea of Ahsoka the White. You know, Filoni has freely said that the Lord of the Rings is a huge influence on him. And so the idea of, like, this is her Gandalf moment, I think Rosario has called it in interviews and stuff like that. This is just so powerful for this character.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, and as I mentioned earlier, I just think so much of this ending is so Empire Strikes Back in elements, because same thing, you know, we don't know where the story is going to go. You know, one of our heroes has been whisked away by the villains. And here you have also, I'm with you, Jen, you know, every time I watch this episode and Hera says, "May the Force be with you," it always brings me to tears. It's so beautiful. But Ahsoka's last line, you know, she says, "Hera, I'll find them. I promise." There is this sense of, I don't know, like, just as Ahsoka has tremendous faith in where she's going, I have tremendous faith in Ahsoka. Yeah, she is. I believe that promise. I believe she's going to fulfill that promise. And she's committed to bringing this family back together. You know, so much of the episode or so much of the series starts with, it's kind of a fractured family and they're finding their way back together. And Ahsoka kind of needs to be the one to do that. And she is now committed to that work. And it's so beautiful.
Absolutely.
So, I don't know about you two, but I still feel like, there's so many things I want to talk about from the show that we didn't talk about because limiting ourselves to five is just so darn hard. I mean, I was like, man, there are a couple episodes in this series where I could come up with five favorite moments, let alone the whole series. But
right.
Yeah, this, I think this was a great initial conversation. I'm sure we'll be back to revisit the Ahsoka show more and more. And I'm just going to say this for myself, but this is why I also appreciate when there's not a deluge of Star Wars content, because I very much, I mean, and to be fair, I love all the Star Wars content that we've gotten. But when there is something I love, like I could immerse myself in the Ahsoka series for another year, and be very content with that. So, I think that's the thing, you know, there's so many Star Wars podcasts in the world today and they all do great things, but so many of them are just always focused on only the new things. And it stinks because when there's something, you know, even like Ahsoka now for so many other spaces, it's like, oh, that's old news. But like, to me, it's like, man, I'm going to keep chewing on this for the rest of my life, just like I have the have the movies. And I don't know if I said this on air or maybe I just said it in an Instagram post, but I know my love for Ahsoka is something huge because for me with Star Wars and specifically the movies, they're such a comfortability to Star Wars. Like when I put on a movie, it's like throwing on a nice flannel or a nice warm blanket. And a lot of times it's like they inhabit kind of even the background. You know, I'll put on a Star Wars movie and just dally about some other things. Ahsoka has become that. No other Star Wars series, and honestly, no really even other Star Wars Disney movie hasn't inhabited that space for me like the Ahsoka show does. So that's just, I mean, I love it so much. It just, it presses all the Star Wars buttons for me. And I know I will want to be talking about this series for a very long time. And hopefully, Jen, you'll come back and dissect it some more with us.
Yeah, anytime. You do not have to twist my arm to talk about Ahsoka or the series at all. It's interesting because as I'm thinking back on it, now that we've sort of had more time, like you said, to rewatch it, to digest it, you know, it's far from a perfect or flawless series, like in terms of just a series of episodic storytelling. But the highs for me are so incredibly high, and it brings me so much joy. And that's hard to compete. Like, I would say that, like, you know, I think, and not everyone agrees with this, obviously, but I think Andor is one of the best Star Wars stories to be told, probably since the original trilogy. And I know that's a hot take on the show.
It is on this show, but you would not be. There are a lot of folks that are right there with you.
Yeah. But it's like I say that more as from a place of admiration than of love. Whereas this series comes from a place of love, you know what I mean? Like where it's like, this just personally makes me so happy. Even if Andor is perfectly written, has some of the best written monologues I've ever seen in anything. and it's sort of like there was like a romantic poet that had this idea of like the perfect urn or something like that. It almost has kind of like a sublime, Andor sort of has a sublime quality to it because it is so precise and so well done. But this show, despite all its flaws, still has my heart.
Yeah. I hear that. I mean, over the weekend, seeing the new Ghostbusters movie and talking to all my friends about Ghostbusters 2 will forever be my favorite Ghostbusters movie, in spite of the fact that it's not perfect. I mean, the first movie is perfect, but I will always prefer the second one. It has my heart. I love the way you put that, Jen, right? It's that effective. And again, like, you know, as you said, Jason and I are not the biggest fans of the Andor show, but I think we both agree that it is a brilliantly made show. And I like the way you put it. Like, I admire it as great storytelling, but it is one of my least favorite. It is my least favorite Star Wars thing ever. So as far as like live action goes, and that's not to say that it's bad. It's just it's not my cup of Star Wars tea. You know, that is a fine wine, but I just want a Yoo-Hoo. So, you know,
it's not your cup of Jawa juice.
Yeah.
It's not the cup that you're going to be able to move across the table.
Right. Exactly.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, before that's yeah. Sorry, Jason. Go ahead.
To sort of wrap up the conversation. But yes, Jen, thank you so much for coming on. And if people want to, you know, get involved with anything else that you're doing, where can people do that?
Sure. So you can find my writing at thelongtake.substack.com. And so that's Substack is sort of a hybrid blog, a newsletter. So you can subscribe for free and you'll get all of my reviews right into your inbox. I review any new Marvel or Star Wars. I'm writing about it. So I'm covering weekly breakdowns of every new episode of The Bad Batch right now. So if you're following along with that show, you can subscribe and get those. I also host a film podcast called The Long Take Review. So that's all. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. We do like to do Star Wars periodically, more when there's movie news related to Star Wars. But we did do a season retrospective of Ahsoka and sort of like snuck it in under the auspices of like, well, like this has implications for the Mandoverse movie, right? So we couldn't talk about it on the show. So it's a film podcast that like strays towards Star Wars occasionally. And then you can follow me on Instagram and Threads at Sobchakchai, Sobchakchai.
Great. Yeah, and I will say, I am certainly no film person like you, Jen, or PT or our buddy Greg, but I loved your episodes on Dune. That movie,
of
those movies, like blew me in a way that I didn't expect. And listening to the three of you talk about them was just such a treat. I mean, all three of you are just so freaking brilliant. So listening to the two of you break down Dune, and I also really appreciated like PT bringing such a depth of knowledge for the novels. Like I just got Dune Messiah in the mail. I'm excited to jump into it and all its craziness. But I mean, the three of you just bring such brilliance to everything you talk about. So a lot of times I can't touch it because it's like, I don't know those things. But when I was like Dune, I was like, yes. Oh, man, like sink me in the sands of Arrakis. if you are a Dune person, you got to check out Long Take Reviews, two parts on the Dune series. It's absolutely brilliant.
Well, thank you.
Lisa Nagaib.
Yes. Lisa Nagaib. Every time he opens it, every time he opens a Snapple, oh, Lisa Nagaib. Jessica's having trouble with a pickle jar, but Paul gets it. Lisa Nagaib. Oh, anyway. Jen, thank you. Yes, Jen, thanks again for being with us. And I know you've got such busy schedules, and you do so many great, between your Substack and your own podcast adventures. So thank you for making time to be with us. It's always appreciated.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to unleash pure unadulterated love for Star Wars.
A surprise to be sure, but a welcome one.
But a welcome one. Yeah. And if you ever feel the need to unleash pure unadulterated love onto Star Wars in any other form, hit us up. You know, you've got a seat at the table here.
Yes.
And Carl, with that, as we wrap this up, where can people get in touch with us if they want to give us their top five moments from Ahsoka or comment on any of our discussion that we've had here today?
Absolutely. Well, we are on Instagram at The Wampas Lair. You can also follow us on Twitter at Wampas Lair or email us at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com.
Excellent. And any final thoughts before we close out this episode?
No, I was trying to think of a quick, fun Ahsoka line, and I got nothing. So,
in that case, I think we'll just say, may the Force be with you. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening to this episode of the Wampas Lair podcast. It's been episode number 551, Top 5 Ahsoka Moments. For Carl and Jen, I'm Jason, and we'll see you next time here in the Wampas Lair.